We've talked yesterday about specific ways to work for inclusiveness, and one of those ways is to use inclusive language. And Megan was here and found a poem that she said she thinks we'll have some begin our dialogue today on inclusive language. So I'm going to ask you to start by reading the poem.
Okay. Yesterday, Chuck and I were talking about how oftentimes the word black has very negative connotations, and the word white has positive connotations. And I found this poem in a book by Blake that I believe he's trying to say we're all equal under the skin, but it comes out in a very backhanded way. So this is an example of non-inclusive language. It's called The Little Black Boy. It says, "My mother bore me in the southern wild, and I am black. But oh, my soul is white. White as an angel is grown. White as an angel is the English child, but I am black, as if bereaved of light. My mother taught me underneath a tree, and sitting down before the heat of day, she took me on her lap and kissed me, and pointing to the east, began to say, 'Look on the rising sun, there God does lie, and gives his light, and gives his heat away. And the flowers and the trees and the beasts and man receive comfort in the morning, joy in the noonday, and we are put on earth a little space, that we may learn to bear the beams of love. And these black bodies and the sunburnt face is but a cloud, and like a shady grove. For when our souls have learned that heat to bear, the clouds will vanish, and we shall hear his voice saying, come out from the grove, my love and care, and around my golden tent like lambs rejoice. Thus did my mother say and kiss me, and thus I say to the little English boy, when I from black and he from white cloud free, and round the tent of God we like lambs, and round the tent of God like lambs we joy. I'll shade him from the heat, till he can bear to lean in joy upon our father's knee, and then I'll stand and stroke his silver hair and be like him, and he will then love me."
Do you have something you wanted to share there?
Well, yeah, I think another kind of, if we talk about power of language to shape reality in a real way, and I think having the hearing impaired week this week reminds us of that in another way, that language is a powerful, powerful part of our lives. Just this morning as we were doing Ephesians in the Bible study, Ephesians 5, starting around 6, "Let no one deceive you with empty words, for it is because of these things that the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not associate with them, for once you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of the light, for the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true, and try to learn what is pleasing to the Lord. Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. For it is a shame even to speak of the things they do in secret, but when anything is exposed by the light, it becomes visible, for anything that becomes visible is light. Therefore it is said, 'Awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give you light.'"
Thank you both. I think that's pretty much an introduction, although that's a pretty subtle thing that we're saying, and I'm not sure that we all recognize the power of language and the power of imagery in our own languages. And I've noticed here that when female language is used for God, female pronouns, that folks go, or that we use words very much according to how we've been taught and not always check out what we're really saying. And I have a quote here that says, "Language not only expresses ideas and concepts, which we all can understand. We express ourselves in ideas and concepts, but actually shapes thought. Language shapes thought. So that if we associate what some of what Chuck was reading, it gets real close when we associate darkness with evil all the time. What happens is that we start thinking lightness as goodness, and we translate that into skin color. So that all of a sudden, white, light skin is better than, is good, and dark skin is evil. That's so subtle that we don't always recognize it, but it is very much, very much there. For me, that's the key to talking about inclusive, liberating language, is to recognize that we laden a lot of our language with good and bad imagery that we don't even think about. We use a word like minority. White folks use a word like minority all the time, the minorities. In what context? In what context? In the world situation, if you're blonde, white, and blue-eyed, you are the minority. There is no one in the world than the Earth's surface that there are fewer than you, unless you are, but in terms of categories of people, that's the minority. So what is the context for using the word minority? And so practicing language is to ask some of those questions. We transmit to people then, not only the whole what's good and bad, but we transmit to the people who receive and are learning the language self-understandings. So that when we use light and dark and white and black, we transmit to kids or others a self-identity. You know, and that's where that poem is so powerful, because it says, you're black and that's wonderful because someday God's going to love you. But once you get to heaven. And what happens to black people when they go to heaven? They turn white.
Inside you have a white soul.
Right, you have a white soul. Well, I have some examples of that just from different places, but hold that blackness. And now think of... if you're a young girl, maybe 3 or 4 years old, and language is starting to become very important to you at that point, and you're starting to control the world around you with the ability to talk or to use language, and every time you hear God, you hear He. Every image of God as birth giver, creator, is rather father, sovereign, king, power, you know, that there's this kind of, what happens to you as a little girl? And then if all the imagery when you talk about brotherhood or mankind, if you hear those words, as a 3-year-old, you don't make the distinction and say, well, brotherhood means me too. Or man, because 3-year-olds are much more
literal, concrete,
and they hear that and they know what that means. Brotherhood means men and boys, and mankind means men. Now, I'm not a child development person, and so I don't know all that stuff, and some of you here know a lot more than I do, but we do know something those are very formative years of self-concept. What if you grow up hearing only that imagery? What happens to the person who knows that God is father, God is male, that the most important people are that celebrate mankind and brotherhood, and that you have to participate in that, but you know somehow that that's not you, that you're second class, or that you're not included, and if to be created in God's image is to be created male. So that language can be, and it's not until persons are often in their 20s and, you know, late teens and 20s where the explanations that, well, mankind means everyone, it's a generic term. Brotherhood means all of us. Well, of course, God's not a male. God's spirit, and spirit has no gender. But by that time, the damage of that may have profound effects on society if males are in God's image.
I'm not sure even the last one you said is often always said.
Well, I'm being
that God is not a male. I mean, I think God, in many places that still is. I mean, there is that image, and it's affirmed that God somehow is male.
I was worshiping in a church that I accompanied on piano in past years, just a couple months ago, and I was sitting there listening to a sermon in which the pastor called people heretics who want to. He said he was talking about changing the language of the Bible to include female images of God. But what he was really saying was people who think of God as female too are heretics. And I was alienated from the entire congregation for the rest of the service. Mm-hmm. And it's the most horrible feeling. I just hate that. But it happens.
What do you say to people who believe, you know, the Bible is the word of God and it says that God is a male and that's the way it is? What do you say to people? I mean, I certainly don't believe that, but...
Most of them don't come to my church.
Yeah. They don't come to my church either. We pray Father, another God.
Yeah. Because where it carries down is into practice. Those languages carry into practice, and then we don't have women pastors. And for part of it is because God, you have to be in the image of God more, and male. And I mean, it gets all tied up, and those arguments don't make sense to me anymore, so it's hard for me to present them. But it is, what do I say to them? First of all, I look constantly am aware of that there are, that's not just, we've chosen certain biblical imagery, and we use it over and over and over and over again. You would think that if you read the Bible, that the word for God was Father. I mean, that must have been the most used word for God in the whole Bible, which is not. You know, even Jesus uses Abba, Daddy, in a real different way than sometimes what we use Father, because we Abba, Daddy comes kind of a very personal, intimate relationship, mm-hmm. and we use Father in a king, head of, mm-hmm. totally distant ruler, judge kind of imagery. So we've attached all kinds of other stuff to it that we've even separated from the way Christ used it, introducing a whole new concept, or wasn't a whole new concept, but a very small concept, saying God is intimate, love, relationship. Jesus talks about God as Father, but Jesus also talks about God as mother hen, brooding over her chicks.
Where's that? Mother hen?
Yeah, in... You can.
That's in Luke. You
know. It's Luke, I think.
We're the three parables. The parable of the lost coin.
Uh-huh. Now, and in the parable of the lost coin, God is like a woman who has 10 coins and one is lost. So what I do to the answer that question is to say we can seek other images. The Bible is not limited to just male images of God. The other part of that, and you read some of the Psalms and some of that stuff, you have wonderful flowing language of God as birth giver, and I love that, the birth-giving God. There's a sense of the pain and anguish and flowing waters that come out of birth-giving, which is different than the lightning of zap. There it is, you know, there's... Mm-hmm. There's a connectedness, so I use that kind of imagery, and I think that's consistent. Mm-hmm. The other part of that is that the Bible is a book written in a time where the societal assumptions were that women were not whole human beings. I mean,
that doesn't fly. Because they say, nope, just the word of God.
Yeah, that's right. This is the word of God.
Just help hand those people.
Yeah, and that's where there's no, for me to say there's no right and wrong there, because it's a basic understanding of the Bible as book of the Word of God. And you know, we don't argue that, because you're going to stand, I'm going to stand here and you're going to stand there. But I share that for me, that's a living word, a life-giving word. And where the final interpretation comes is, does it make the God that Jesus talks about, and the God that we know is God of creation and God of love. God so loved the world. God saw all that God had made, and it was good. You know, God so loved the world. So those are kind of some of the basic, and if you had been to our first session eight sessions ago, we talked about those underlying themes for me. A God of justice. Not the scales of blind justice, but the justice weighted in favor of the oppressed and the poor. And when you talk about language, women are oppressed by language, weighted in favor of those things. And then to look at Jesus' life and actions are most liberating for me. Jesus talked to the Samaritan woman. Jesus talked to women all over the place. When it wasn't good. I mean, let's hold that strand. And then talk about inclusive language in the images of black and white. Okay? Black is often equated with evil. And you think about what I'd said about the little girl who hears that God is male and brotherhood is the norm. Think about what it might mean for a person whose skin is black to grow up hearing our language. Ozzie Davis has a book called The English Language is My Enemy, 1967, and it's a wonderful, wonderful book. But he noted that in the thesaurus, which black children use, the thesaurus, boy, if I have to say that one more time, we're in trouble. Which black children use, there are 134 synonyms for whiteness, like purity, cleanness, blonde, trustworthy. For blackness, black children will read dirty, nigger, negro, negress, darky, threatening, blotch. We're going to spend some more time on that in a few minutes, talking about how we might use inclusive language and move away from using images of blackness as being equated with evil. That there are other ways of saying, including saying evil, rather than saying black. And I would add saying dark, because at that point we move, that gets so close in our language that we're really in trouble. So we'll leave that and come back to it, because that's what we'll work on. But the third example I have is one that's a little more difficult for me to articulate, because it's the newest one in my working towards inclusiveness. And that's talking about handicapped persons. That somehow we label people by some physical condition that somehow limits who they are as human beings, or that limits them as human beings. The deaf one, you know, means somehow that person, the most important characteristic of that person is deaf, and that limits them from being a part of. Handicap, in and of itself, when you think handicap, you think not whole, not a full human being. And that's been kind of implied in our language, so that looking for other ways to say that word may help. If I grow up and I can't hear, and I'm labeled handicapped by society, I learn real quick what the meaning of that word is. That means I'm not like other people, I'm not whole, I'm different. So when we talked yesterday about how cumbersome some new language is, like otherly able,
physically challenged,
those are tough labels, as tough words for us to use, but they, when someone uses otherly abled or differently abled, even though it's, we immediately sit up and say, oh yes, they're human beings, and the new label helps us get beyond holding someone's physical characteristic as their personhood.
Recently at the statewide conference on childhood deafness, there was a leader, a deaf woman, who actually produced the film that we showed the other night. What was the name of it? Love Is Never Silent. And she was saying the same thing, that she wanted deaf people to come up with a new word that wasn't deaf, because that only says, you know, black. And she was saying, try to come up with something like seeing. And I thought of a word, it's another one of those cumbersome ones, but it's like visually oriented. They're not deaf, they're visually oriented.
That's neat.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, that's helpful kinds of ways to remind people that we're still human beings and we're still whole, even if we have a physical difference, be it skin color or hearing impaired or whatever, that to identify people by those characteristics is often to limit their personhood. A fourth example of language is sometimes we take a group of people, use their name to describe another situation, another characteristic. So we say, Jew down. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to Jew them down, or she Jewed me out of some money. You have never heard that. Oh, it's wonderful. Maybe young folks
are. Oh, boy, I sure did.
I've heard it. And there are a lot of contexts where we use. And what is it saying? It's saying that we can use the word Jew to say that someone is financially stingy or money grabbing or
aggressive.
Financially aggressive. So we use the word Jew, not in the context of describing a group of people, but to just take a characteristic, which is a stereotype, a myth, a lie, and make that reality into something else. Another really powerful example is Indian.
Indian giver.
What does that say about Indians?
They take back what they give, which is just exactly opposite. That's what we've done to them all these
years.
Yes,
we have taken a characteristic of what white people did to Native Americans and then labeled them with that label.
And if we, the at least, for example, in the Northwest, the coastal culture of the potlatch, the giveaway.
Yes.
which is still practiced by many Native peoples in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, when young children have a naming ceremony at the age of getting their name, the tradition is that you give away gifts to family and
your
friends.
Status is built by how much
you
give.
Gave away. I mean,
virtually,
it was outlawed on the West Coast. I mean, that was the whole thing, the whole giveaway that societies were built instead of going to war, their way of entering into combat, as it were, was to host giveaways in which blankets and tools, everything else, the tribe or the leader that could give away the most was the most powerful and important person in the community. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, that whole history.
We outlawed it. What a war of decent people.
and then turn that around and say, well, you're an Indian.
Well, and we have, and it's subtle, because we talk about things like Indian summer.
Which is a pleasant thing, right?
Except it's not real, it's a cheat.
Yeah, that's right.
It's the false summer, the cheating summer. The not real summer.
What is it? I forget.
That's the time.
After the first frost. When you get the
again.
Heat wave again, where it might get into the 60s and 70s.
It's a positive time, but it is using a negative characteristic of false. So we've tried to remember to talk about this is false summer, you know.
Or second summer.
We try to find language that eliminates grouping people by characteristics. Okay. Maybe you can come up with some more, Joel, because you've been in different parts. You might be more sensitive to. I couldn't. Last night, as I was thinking about all those were the ones. The Jew and the Indian were the two that really.
Well, but also the imagery of just last night having a conversation with one of the rangers, and kind of the he was talking about the transition of the Forest Service. The Forest Service traditionally were the people who put out the fires and that, you know, serve and protect them. So that was a very positive image. And now with, you know, timber interests and resource management and all of that, it's much more, you know, Forest Service people are more in conflicting roles, you know. And he talked about, well, you know, we always used to wear the white hat. You know, we were the good guys, we wore the white hats. And, you know, mm-hmm. now sometimes we're the bad guys, we wear the black hats, you know. Some people see us in that role, you know, that we use our language to...
It did occur to one thing, that we're not only using the name of a people, but even artifacts from their culture then can become like Taco
hat.
Town, you know.
Taco Town. The hat, the Mexican
sombrero.
And,
yeah, but even
but
using
that's
it in
a
language,
symbol, you know,
yeah.
to put that in a cartoon is to say this,
right.
or something about this person, lazy,
right.
da 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 da
right.
da da. So we have people, part of their culture, we use that as a symbol
mm-hmm.
of and what is our, what do our kids buy first thing? They go to Central America, so or Mexican, they buy sombreros, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
they think about Mavis.
Right.
So I have to keep going here, and then we can come back. I have one more comment about language, and that's talking about naming. How powerful and important it is, the naming process. When you have children, that is not a simple thing to just say, well, let's call that one Babe, and that one Babe 2, and that one Babe 3. I mean, naming is an important part of our lives, and it gives us, it's our part of our identity. Lots of times our culture, naming happens very, very quickly, because you spend time in the preparation for naming. Other cultures, naming comes Babe 1, Babe 2, Babe 3 for a long time until the time that person's identity starts to show, and then you can find a name that fits the identity. You know, the native cultures are really good about doing that, to know that. So now, today, we have Native American friends whose kids have names, English names, James. We have a friend who's James. His real name is Hawk, but for the school's sake, he's James. So they gave him that James name so that he can function in the schools and in the public world, but his naming didn't happen until he was much older. I think 5 or 6 he had named, which is an interesting thing because the girls aren't named till much later.
In terms of their real name,
the culture, the name that makes them a part of
mm-hmm.
of who they are.
Do they call them that at home? They
yeah.
call them Hawk at home?
Yeah.
yeah.
Can they say Hawk, or is there in their native tongue term?
Hawk. He's Hawk.
Yeah, he was, or Hawkers.
Hawkers, really.
yeah, the diminutive,
yeah.
you know, I mean, the same kind of nicknaming in the
yeah.
sense of an endearing term. Hawkers was an endearing
mm-hmm.
term.
But they used to follow me around and I'd say, well, what's his name? Because when we first moved into our community, what's his name? And I'd say, his name is Matthew. And say, what do you call him? I'd say, Matt. No, what's his real name? Matt. Huh? That's our son, you know. And I say, no, his real name. I say, man. One day, I had that went on for a year, and one day I was working out.
You didn't understand that there.
I didn't understand the question. And then one day I was working out in the garden, and Renee, which is, because she hadn't been named yet, Renee was following me around. Said, what's his real name? And I said, I don't know. She left, and pretty soon she came back and was standing there, and Matt was working behind me, and I said, Bear, would you get... And I always called him Bear. And she went,
where did you get Bear from?
Since he was little, I always called him Bear. I mean, you got to know Matt was about this big, and he lumbered.
Yeah.
And he just, so I always called him Bear. And she just went, ah.
Yeah.
She knew his name.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that power in naming. That's different than labeling. Okay, and we tend to label other groups. So we want to say they are the Negroes. You know, that's our name for them. They are ladies. You know, that's our way of labeling that group of women. We're going to say the ladies, the girls.
The broads.
The broads.
The chicks.
Those are we label.
Control yourself.
The frows.
The frows.
The frows.
Never mind. He doesn't have a black eye, but he almost did. But we take groups and we want to name them. So again, an early example of that was the people in power named Christians. That was not a positive term. That was a name for those people who were following Jesus of Nazareth. And it was very derogatory because they thought Jesus was the Christ. So make them Christians. And it was negative until the people who followed Christ said, yes, that is who we are. That is our identity and we're proud of it. But initially, that was a labeling. Lutherans. Martin Luther would die again. We are not always successful, none of us. But one of the ways to avoid labeling is to ask people, what do you wish to be called? Are you an interpreter or are you a signer? You know,
I'm an interpreter.
You're an interpreter. And I'm learning that this week. That's a word that's new to me this week. And I'm saying, okay, these folks who want to be called, they name themselves interpreters. I will use that word. I may have trouble with it, and I may have to struggle because it's a new word for me, but that's something I've learned this week. How do you want to be called? How do you call yourselves? So people that are black in this country are not, black folks aren't really black. You know, if you look at there, they come in many shades of brown, but there's really not a black. But when you say, how do you wish to be called? You hear, we wish to be called black. We take that negative, like we took Christian, we take that negative label and we claim it as something beautiful and positive. We claim that and we want you to recognize that. Do you want to be called Indian or Native American or what? For us, we use Native American because that's what we've heard folks wanting to say. That is not consensus. And so if I'm with a group of Native Americans, I will say, what do you want to be called? And then five different people will give you five different answers. Mm-hmm. And so it's not easy. And then you say, if I use Native American, will I offend? If I use Indian, do I offend?
You know, Are there any other options other than that you know for that group?
Well,
we have labels like red men.
Redskins. There are other labels, but those are two that are positive. When we talk about Hispanic, we are running into a tremendous amount of our white stereotyping and labeling. Because what we want to do is we want to claim that Mexicans, Central Americans, Nicaraguans, South Americans, are all the same. And so we want this label that covers all of those folks. And we end up seeking our own comfort levels of finding a label that fits rather than hearing what people want to be called. And we had a lot of trouble with Chicanos. Because a certain group folk who were, I think that was mostly Mexican, wanted that label, but folks that were from other parts of Central America didn't want that label. That wasn't who they were. And so we...
The other problem, even Hispanic, it's linked to Spain, you know, and that it's the colonial imagery that's still part of it.
Well, that's the same with Asian and Oriental.
Sure.
You know, Oriental is really often a very derogatory for a lot of folks. They prefer, and groups that we've talked to want to be called Asian. That doesn't mean that everybody's consistent, but one of the things we've done, because we work in Lutheran circles, is check with the Lutheran groups. You know, like now we have the Black desk and Hispanic desk, and so they've given us some clue as how they name themselves in that circle. But I would be very careful if I was sitting in this room before I would use Hispanic. I would check and say, what is the label? What is the title? What is your name? How do you wish to be called? Tough stuff, because it's easier the other way.
There's also an additional complication in that, it depends on the level of sort of political awareness and sophistication of the group as well, in which what we might consider to be a liberating term for them is offensive because they're living still in under the old assumptions about who they are.
How many, you talk to women and they'll say, well, it doesn't bother me to be called a girl.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lady.
Especially
that. You know, well, and folks say, well, I didn't mean anything by being called a lady. I like being called a lady, you know. Well, that's not because the word's wrong, it's just that there's a different understanding. When I hear lady, I have a very limited view of personhood. Lady limits personhood, you know, because I was told young lady and young ladies don't.
Right.
And there were so many limits, you know, you wore stockings and young ladies don't wear jeans and ladies don't. And women do, so I'm a woman.
That'd be a great bumper sticker. Ladies don't, women do.
I like it. New theology. So it's not easy, whenever we do inclusive language stuff, to make it seem that there's a right and a wrong, to make it seem that there's an easy way to change your language to be inclusive, there isn't. But there is a mindset that says, I'm going to check out what I'm saying, and I am not going to label people by my feelings, but I'm going to hear what those folks...
We shared yesterday that in the Lutheran Church today, the grouping label that people have chosen, Black, Native American, Hispanic, Asian, are persons of color as a group rather than minority. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how the people in the church have chosen.
People of color /
Yeah, and really it's persons of color and primary language other than English is the whole phrase. And again, we trip a lot over that, you know, and it gets abbreviated to POC or, you know, whatever, or just to persons of color. But again, that's a matter of the choice of people choosing that as communities. And frankly, I need to share that I've been kind of surprised, because here at Holden, I have heard more persons in the last 10 days talk about colors.
Yes.
Using the language for talking about black persons. You know,
as guests.
As guests, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the colors.
We don't
have any colors.
That's kind of surprised me in the sense of, because, you know, and maybe it's some isolation or I don't know what. Because,
yeah. I mean, because white people are black, we tend to learn things a little faster.
Well, but also in a nation where, I mean, I think it's pretty we're with the media. And you know, I mean, we have had a black presidential candidate, a legitimate black presidential candidate, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's not as if
we've got a legitimate lady too, vice president.
You know, and so, but it is, you know, a reminder that sometimes it's difficult to change perceptions. And
I think especially in rural areas of the country, I think that has changed surprisingly little. I mean, that's my mm-hmm. experience when I go to my home. I mean, that's not unusual at all to hear that.
No, and
I think if people are raised on that term, some people just, like you said, you know, if you're in an isolated area enough, I think of, I don't know what the age range of these people who you've been hearing coloreds from, but I would guess they were, you know, older, and that's, you know, what they...
Actually, it
was. For them, that was the respectful term at the time.
It's been cross-generational.
Mm-hmm. Really? I am surprised.
Yeah, we were too. We have too. We've been really thinking about that.
I always like to ask, what color are you referring to?
Which color? One of our favorite sayings is people say, I don't care if people are green or purple, they're all the same. And we say, well, what about brown people? You know?
Yeah.
Usually that green and purple is really not very relevant
right.
to the people that we're talking about. And we're talking about skin colors of different skin colors that are real. And lots of times that's to distance ourselves from the fact there's no green and purple people, but there are brown, lots of shades of browns
mm-hmm.
and tans and goldens and bronzes.
And we had a struggle with our altar guild. We were getting some new pyramids. We're getting new green pyramids.
Yeah.
And
green
they,
what?
Pyramid. The hangs that hang on the lectern.
You have the stuff that you put red ones up for certain times of years and green
oh,
ones.
Yeah, yeah.
Liturgical churches.
You use
right.
white ones for Easter because it's a sign of purity, and black ones for
yeah.
Friday
for death.
For death.
Right.
But in any case, we were getting new green pyramids, and they wanted to have a symbol of unity, so they wanted to have hands grasping. And we suggested that we have like a brown and a black hand and one white hand. And they just struggled and struggled. Finally, they came back with a compromise saying, well, maybe we could have a white hand. And because when we talked about the different shades of, you know, that black, you know, that they thought, well, then maybe we ought to have a white hand and a gray hand because,
gray.
You know,
gray.
Gray.
That was their compromise.
Right.
Gray.
They wanted two hands, right?
Right. Yeah, they wanted two hands and one
unity,
hand to be white.
A symbol
and,
of unity.
And they just... The visual symbol of a black or brown hand grasping a white
on the altar
so they came up, well, you know, there really aren't any really black people, you know, the shades and you know, so they thought, you know, gray would be an appropriate shade of black.
And I tell you, the only time I've ever seen a gray person is not.
I was a nurse.
Actually, if you wanted to get technical, the right colors would be green and gray, because those are the two tissuary colors.
Mm.
The
yeah.
gray makes, if you take a pink pigment and mix green into it, you get the olive and white flesh tones.
Mm.
If you mix gray
yes,
into
Italians
it,
have a lot more
you
green.
Get the, you get the brown.
Mm-hmm.
And the browns and the darker colors.
Yeah.
Huh.
And those would be two appropriate colors.
So our church has a big painting that has colors in like brown, you know, all those many, many different shades. They're all kind of all in together.
But it was just, you know, the women just decided, and again, the unreality of, you know, where we had
what
to say,
happened?
Well, when have you ever seen a gray person?
A black and white.
You know,
because the pastors had final say.
Black. Or
it's darker than they had, or it was supposed to be a dark brown, but it looks
yeah,
even darker.
It came
pretty close
got,
to the guy. Then you have to understand that the artist then has to, who designs it has to hear that too. The women weren't real good at it, being able to interpret what they weren't so sure we were talking about.
but it's just, you know, it's a real struggle for all of us.
What I had here, and this probably will lead us into other places, was I wanted to share a piece from this.
Well, it's an insert from a national insert from a black newspaper. It's kind of like the kind of the national inserts you get in your Sunday paper that are, you know, it's got some specific things to your area, but a lot of it is, you know.
And this one, it was called, it's an opinion page, and it's called Wall Street's Racist Language. And I thought, since we're still close to some of what happened at Wall Street last fall, here are some headlines from papers last fall. After Black Monday, crash, and then on Wall Street, New York is riding out. And here's one, how a handful of brokers and traders survived Black Monday and its scarier aftermath. That it permeates all levels of our language. And I thought, you know, we can talk about that all day, but sometimes it's helpful to just give you an example. I'll read, and then you tell me how you might change that sentence to keep its meaning, but to take it away from those people who are going to feel that they're superior because they're white, or someone growing up feeling inferior because they're black, to take our language and change it in a way that could be more expressive and yet not carry that. Here's one. Uncle Joe is the black sheep in our family. What might you say?
Uncle Joe is the odd person in our family.
Okay.
That See, would be... as an interpreter, I have to do that all the time because some of those hearing idioms that you have don't make sense in sign language. If you're not growing up in this society, your uncle's a sheep? What? You know? So you'd have to interpret
odd
that.
Person.
The odd outcast. Person.
Outcast. Outcast. The other part of it is this. To say something, there's other part of that language there is to say, saying that you're putting Uncle Joe over there as yeah. being.
Or Uncle Joe is different, the different mm-hmm. one in our family, because that
can
also take away from value of the odd, which tends to be more negative. I mean, different isn't, for me at least, doesn't ring as.
I don't think that's the meaning of that sentence, though. That sentence means he's.
You have to be careful, I think, to not also insert more values into
your
it.
Your values, that's right.
How would you say that that person is a black sheep? You'd say outcast, different than, odd. But recognizing that we're also taking Uncle Joe and putting him in a category
that makes him
all right. After Hours, that's a quote, is considered a black comedy. You have to explain.
I've never ever been quite sure what that meant.
That I said to Chuck, he had to help me with this one because I never quite understood what black comedy is because it's really it's
the
kind
cast
of a
black.
No.
It's a type of comedy,
serious.
Yeah,
it's comedy
or like humorless comedy or.
It's like you laugh.
Ironic heavy.
Ironic, maybe the best kind of. It's a deep irony that. It may be that reading. Your,
is it kind of
when she read that poem, there's kind of that sense of black humor. It's not funny, but it's so not funny that we laugh.
Morose,
those would be better. But black comedy, to get away from that sense. Mm-hmm. This is a clear-cut black and white issue.
Yeah. I still find myself using that many times.
I do too. What are you really saying?
Right
or wrong?
This is a clear-cut issue.
This is a clear-cut issue.
Because it's almost redundant.
Exactly. It's not always right or wrong. Sometimes it's one way or another.
Yeah, it's one way or the other.
Yeah, right or wrong
because
is good.
Right or wrong.
Black and white could be readable too, as we have black print on white paper.
Right. And then there's nothing really laden on that black print on white paper.
Mm-hmm. It's there in black and white. There, it's not. There's no images to it. But when it's right and wrong, then we ought to say right and wrong.
Right. So if and that's where these things aren't real clear. That was the thing I noticed as I was writing these. That sometimes we think we're being very clear when we say black and white. And we're really not, because when we try to interpret this to find another way of saying it, it's,
I don't know what you're saying.
We're not, might be better to say, this is clearly right or wrong. You have clear decisions here. Clear, the issues are very
definable.
So there's ways to avoid using that kind of.
We talk about gray issues too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think if there aren't situations where we use black and white to say, to talk about the really opposite, mm-hmm. without them being one being, you know, they're being laden right or wrong.
Having a value judgment.
Yeah. I think that may be true.
I think there are, but in this kind of statement, usually when you say it's a black and white issue, that you really say if
yeah.
you're real, there's really the black part of that issue isn't the part you want to be on.
Often that's
often.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure about that.
I'm trying
to think of an example where I...
I know, I am too.
Well, I think in terms of one of the physicians I work for, I just tell him, I says, it's either black or white with you. There's no in between. I mean, it's either this way or it's that way.
And then you're not... And then
it's just color spectrum.
Then it's just two different opposites.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's true. Opposites.
And then it's not. But if it's black or white...
Right or wrong.
So you're
talking about
then you'll never say the white part is the right and the wrong.
Right.
So I guess we have to be.
There may be a sense in which, even using it in that way, because of our usages of black and white, color is what we are talking about. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because we're so used to thinking of black and white in those terms or being conditioned to that in.
Yeah.
Loads what we're talking about with values.
And if we were working on inclusive language, it might be better to let some of that go.
Yeah.
And find other ways
and so we can
force ourselves into thinking in new ways so that we can come back to a color spectrum too. If you put a black and white crayon together, you know, there's a sense that those are very different. But for a long time to get away from that and all the kind of other stuff.
When Sue said the black and white crayon thing, I was reminded that
you
still can.
If you take a box of Crayola crayon.
Yeah, you know, there still are flesh-colored crayons.
Yeah.
What color are flesh-colored crayons?
That's right.
Peach.
Yeah, and also recently, less than a year ago, I was at the paint store, and they had, you know, the paint samples, and they had a flesh, you know, and it was peachy, pinky.
Yeah.
And you just kind of say, whose?
Oh, yes, nude nylons.
Yeah.
Nude nylon.
Oh.
That.
And all the makeup.
Yeah, the colors of makeup and all kinds of things are based on the norm is white. Except in our neighborhood it isn't, but that's in the most. They blackened my name when they told you that story.
They slandered my name.
Slandered, denigrated.
We blackballed her from church council.
Kicked her out.
Yeah.
Or refused to allow her in.
Or wouldn't let her in. You know, banned her.
This writer always looks on the dark side of things.
Negative.
The manager blackmailed her with information about her past so that she would not take a stand on the issue.
That's tough for you.
Yeah, that's a standard word.
Well, see, except I think we ought to change it to white male.
Because
that's, those are the folks who do it. Right?
What is the word?
Actually, here, it's a threat.
Threatened.
It's a kind of threat.
It's more than just a threat.
But in the sentence, the manager blackmailed her with information about her past. You could say the manager threatened her with information about her past so that she would not take a stand on the issue. You still hold that in that sentence.
Yeah.
It's harder when you talk about blackmail.
Yeah.
You know, and that's when you might need to just say, I'm going to use the word white male here because that's how it usually operates.
Keep your self-concept good and things too. You don't want to cast that on whites either.
That's true.
If you really want to heal things, you know, threatening a person and in a sense holding them.
Extorting money.
Threatened and extorted in lots of different ways. If we
force
put our minds
something with
right threat. Against their will with threat or something, you know.
And it's not like, and if you listen to the synonyms in the thesaurus, some of them really have very little to do with skin and all of that stuff. But in an overview of our language, when black keeps coming out negative, and there are people walking around that are black, they're feeling the language, the impact of the language is, and that's documentable. So we really need to start digging up new imagery.
What about blacklist? Is that when you found it?
Well, I think Blacklist isn't on here. Oh, yes, it is. People in the movie industry were blacklisted.
Yeah. About
for that one. Their political involvement.
Yes, they were.
They, but blacklisted can, you can just say kept out of.
Censored.
Removed from.
Yeah. Cut
off.
Participate.
Yeah, not allowed.
But there's still something there that's not there.
It's often kind of put under, on a list. Yeah, it's kind of, it's not real overt. And a blacklist is kind of, you know, something
that's
kind
a covert.
Of,
that's right.
Yeah, it's not something that, all right, here's the list and nobody
yeah.
hired him.
And those
like,
are names
okay,
that
guys,
were cast around
know?
From producer right. to producer, from
well,
well
then
just,
it
you
is.
You just describe it. You said they were put on a list of people.
A
who were
secret
yeah,
list
of.
People
not to hire.
Communists or secret list of whatever the
people not to hire you.
Suspect.
2 minutes.
All right. I'll give you two more then. I hope this won't be a black mark on my record.
I hope this won't be held against me.
Or a negative mark, yeah. Bad mark.
Bad mark. I hope. It was a dark day when Martin Luther King Jr. died.
Terrible.
Sad.
Terrible.
Sad.
Tragic.
Tragic. Good. Oh, you are really excellent.
One other, I was thinking about that on talking about Black Monday.
Mm-hmm.
What they should have called it is Red Monday, because red is the color of ink they use to describe a mm-hmm. loss.
Mm-hmm. Or
and
tragic.
Black Monday should have been a very successful day.
In the financial, right, that is one of the
right.
few, you know.
If Wall but, Street were consistent with Wall Street's images,
yeah,
they would. They should have used
Red
Monday.
Monday
because Black Monday
right.
need to be
brokers
black.
In the red. Kind of yeah.
the only, and that's the only image that is consistent. We've discovered.
Yeah, but then ones that do for
yeah.
Communist
Monday.
Yeah.
There
you go. Brokers.